We begin the Sefer Bamidbar, and the first place to look is the opening Rashi. Bamidbar, of course, is all about the countings, and Rashi comments, Pasuk Aleph, Perek Aleph, Pasuk Aleph. Mitoch chibosam lefanav, mona osam kol sha'a. Out of love for the Jewish people before Hashem, he counts them constantly. Rashi proceeds to provide examples of when Hashem counted us. It gives two or three examples, when we left Mitzrayim, when we fell at the Egel, which is interesting because it's not constantly, but it's more than you'd think you'd need. And this is Rashi's comment, Mitochi Boson Lefanov. It is because the Jewish people are so beloved to Hashem, he counts them in a way that people who have money count their money. And people count something that's treasured to them. We have in the past looked into this Rashi Bi'iyun, investigated the particulars, but I'd like actually to broaden out our vision by noting that we begin Parshas Chumash Bamidbar with this Rashi. But actually, if you take a look at all the opening comments of Rashi, that is to say, the opening comment for each of the five Chumashim, you will find something very interesting. And that is that each of them highlights the special or beloved or the crucial nature of something important to the Jewish people. And very often, it's the Jewish people themselves. And this is pointed out by my uncle, Rav Kupperman Zatzal, in his Sefer Pshuto Shel Mikra. And he guides us through. And you can see how there's something about the first comment. It sets the tone. It opens the Chumash because it makes a statement. And if we begin literally at the beginning, in Chumash Bereishis, actually Rashi has two opening comments. His famous comment on the word Bereishis is that it's Bishvil Yisrael Shenikru Reishis. The world is created for the sake of Yisrael, who were called Reishis. Reishis Tevuah. So, and for the sake of the Torah, which is called Reishis, Hashem Kanani, Reishis Darko. So the very, literally from the first word, from moment one, we have an expression of the importance and beloved nature of the Jewish people and the Torah. But actually, that's Rashi's first comment on the word Bereishis, but he has a prior first comment, where he discusses why the Torah begins with Bereishis at all. After all, not many mitzvahs in Bereishis. If you're determined, you can find some. But it's not a chumash of mitzvos. Rather, as Rashi says, it is to teach us that if the nations of the world will ever say that we are thieves for taking the land of Israel, so we need to know, Koach ma'asav higid la'amo, la'seis lahem nachalas goyim. That's the pasuk that Rashi quotes. Hashem has demonstrated everything that he's done to give the Jewish people this inheritance of the land of Israel. Because we say to them, Hashem created us, you, everything, whoever he wants to be in the land, that's who's in the land, no one else. We've noted in the past, I wonder if there's ever been any occupying nation who were swayed by this Rashi. I mean, even if one translates it into their vernacular, with footnotes. Nonetheless, I've never heard anyone who hears the Rashi and says, oh, well, our mistake, it's all yours. I think that the Rashi is there for us. We need to be aware of what the response is to the claim of Listim Atem. It could be that not everyone learns the pasuk like Rashi of the nations of the world, but we need to know for ourselves. And so for Rashi, the opening Chumash The opening Rashi in Chumash Bereishis is about the centrality of the land of Israel, the significance of the Torah, the significance of the Jewish people. That's how it all begins. And from that opening Rashi, we move to the opening Rashi of Shemos. And Shemos, of course, as its name suggests, is the names of the tribes who came down to Mitzrayim. The point is, which Rashi responds to, is they've already been mentioned by name in the end of Chumash Bereishis, having gone down to Mitzrayim. Says Rashi, that may well be. But afal pi shemena'an b'chayehem b'shmosam, even though they've already been mentioned during their lifetimes by name, chazar u'mena'an b'misasam, they're mentioned again in retrospect by name, lehodia chibasam, to show how beloved are the Shvatim, and from the Shvatim come the Jewish people. They are literally the branches of the Jewish people. So from Bereishis, which is Torah and the Jewish people and the land of Israel, comes Shemos, which is Shivtei Ka, how beloved they are. What about Vayikra? Vayikra begins with the word Vayikra. Hashem calls to Moshe and speaks to him. And Rashi comments on the concept of calling. What does it mean to call Moshe and then speak to him? Normally, we just have Vayidaber Hashem al Moshe Lemor. Hashem speaks to Moshe. How did he get Moshe's attention? I'm sure he has his ways. But in Vayikra, we're told that it begins with a kriya. He calls to him. And Rashi comments, L'chol dibros, before every dibur, speech, u'l'chol amiros, and every verbal communication, u'l'chol tzivuyim, before every mitzvah, kadma kriya. You should know, Hashem always did this to Moshe. He always called him before he spoke to him. Loshon chiba. It's an expression of how beloved Moshe is to Hashem. He calls him over, so to speak, in order to communicate with him. So Vayikra, at the center of the Torah, has the chiba of Moshe, who is the agent through which Hashem gives us the Torah, the beloved nature of Moshe. From there, we move on, well, back now for us, to Parshas Chumash Bamidbar. And Chumash Bamidbar, again, to see it in this opening Rashi context, it's not just a comment on the topic at hand. It's the opener for Chumash Bamidbar. And it's telling us, once again, the beloved nature of the Jewish people as expressed by the fact that Hashem counts them the whole time, as Rashi proceeds to delineate. This is how this Rashi takes its place in that string of opening Rashis. And all that's left for us now is the fifth Chumash, the opening Rashi to Chumash Devarim. And what do we see there? Chumash Devarim, as actually words of Tochacha, is words of rebuke. And yet, the very first Pasuk is a list of names of places. Bamidbar, Ba'arava, Mosuf, Ben Lavan, Ben Tofel, from place to place. Even though Moshe is, they're all in one place. So why are all these places referred to? Says Rashi, this is Moshe's opening communication with the Jewish people. A veiled reference, an allusion to all the places where they had sinned. Bamidbar and Mulsuf, places where things had paran, where the Meraglim were sent from. But that's not how you begin. Soon enough, Moshe will get down to business. He'll get down to details. No detail will be spared. But that's not how you start. That's not the opening. The opening is, in Rashi's words, Kvodom Shel Yisrael, honor of the Jewish people. It's just an allusion. Allusion with an A. That is to say, out of respect for them, one doesn't explicitly mention anything they did wrong, not on day one. And that is the fifth opening Rashi. So it's really an amazing, sweeping vision, really, of these opening Rashis. And that's Rashi's own way, in addition to telling us what each pasuk means, to tell us how to begin something with Lashon Chiba, and then all the other details can follow. So Chumash Bamidbar, Parshas Bamidbar, certainly is about the counting. The entire Chumash is called Numbers, Chumash HaPikudim, the Chumash of counting. And each Shevet is mentioned how many were in its number. And what's very curious is one of these Shvatim stands out as being unusually less in number than the others. And that, of course, is Shevet Levi. All the others are tens of thousands of 30, 40, 50 and more. And Levi, even counting from 1 month, is just 22,000. And from the age 30 and upwards is 8,000, from 30 to 50. As Ramban puts it, less than half of the smallest of the other tribes. And what are we to make of this? What did Levi do wrong? That there's more of everyone else than there is of them. Says Ramban, I don't think Levi did anything wrong. You just need to understand why the profusion of all of the other tribes was miraculous. In the course of 200 years, they go from 70 to 600,000 times however many to account for everyone else. So really, the question isn't so much why are there so few of Levi? There's probably as many as you'd expect there to be. The question really is why are the other 11 tribes so many? And Levi then not among them? And Ramban gives two explanations. Va'ani choshev, just to read three or four lines from Ramban. Va'ani choshev, in my understanding, sheze chizuk, this lends support, it bolsters, l'masha omer Rabbi Seinu, that which Chazal said, ki shivto shelevi lo hayo b'shibud, shevet Levi were not part of the oppression, they were not part of the backbreaking labor, etc. B'shibud meleches Mitzrayim uva avodas parech, they weren't enlisted in that. So therefore, says Ramban, and the pasuk says v'ka asher ya'anu oso ken yirbe v'chen yifrotz. The pasuk says the more that the Egyptians persecuted Jewish people, the more they increased. Ki haya kadosh baruch hu omer, Hashem said nir'ed davar miyakum. We'll see whose words will endure. Mimeni omehem. Ava Shevet Levi, hayu parim v'ravim k'derech ala aretz. So Shevet Levi, who weren't involved in the difficulties of the oppression, so they just increased it at a normal rate. All of the other tribes who were oppressed increased in this much more profuse rate. So this is Ramban's first explanation, which is once again, it's about kasher yanu so ken yebev v'chen yefrotz. But then Ramban moves on to another explanation, which actually does seem to more emphasize the diminished numbers of Shevet Levi. Ve'ulai, perhaps, says Ramban, hayaze mika'as hazaken aleihem. Perhaps this was as a result of the anger of the zaken, of the elder, over them. Who's the elder? Yaakov. We know Yaakov was angry with two of his sons, Shimon and Levi, for what they did in Shechem, and he cursed them, or he cursed their anger. When he was giving the brachas in Parshas Vayechi, they don't get a very flowery bracha. They get that's quite harsh. Harsh words are said to them, to the extent that one needs to understand how it's considered a bracha. And says Ramban, and Ramban on occasion does this. It's a terrifying way of looking at things to see how certain causes have certain effects. If you want to understand what happened to Levi, they're under the pall of the anger of Yaakov. Not only Levi, also Shimon. And actually, Shimon currently are quite numerous, but they will sustain severe losses by the end of Chumash Bamidbar. Those 24,000 who fall during the time of the of Benos Moab, at the end of Bamidbar, and alongside of them, you see from the numbers that Shevet Shimon goes down precipitously. Shimon is now very numerous. Nismaet, he goes down to 22,000 from much, much more. And what about Levi? In other words, both Shimon and Levi bear the brunt of the anger of Yaakov, so to speak, but in different ways. With Shimon, they actually die, that many of them. Levi, Shumishavet Chasidav, Lo Nismaet B'Mageifa. With Levi, it's not that he undergoes that disaster of some type of plague where many of his number will be destroyed, but rather he never increased that way in the first place. It's almost as if Ramban is saying Shimon and Levi both receive the same anger, but not in the same way, because Levi goes on to in a sense, better things than Shimon. They become much more elevated, and therefore they have a more, so to speak, bechavadika way of bearing this, in that it, from the outset, there aren't as many of them, but they don't suffer casualties in that way. And it's very interesting to see how they're so similar, Shimon and Levi. But at a certain point, they diverge. At the time of Shechem, they're inseparable. They act together as a team. You can't tell them apart. But in the fullness of time, they will separate. We know, based on the tradition, Ramban tells us that Levi were not involved in the persecution of Mitzrayim because they were much more involved in matters spiritual. Not so the other tribes, including Shimon. Levi has pulled away. And dare one say that Levi has pulled away because they took to heart Yaakov's words when he was so harsh with them. And he said to them, this needs to be kept in check. This needs to be channeled in the right way. And Levi took it to heart and began to elevate themselves. And the next time we find an act of zealotry on the part of anyone, it's at the time of the Chet HaEgel. When justice needs to be meted out, but the atmosphere is one of involvement in the Egel. Who will take action? Moshe calls out, Mila Shem Elai. And who comes to him? Shevet Levi. Drawing on what? The same zealousness that led them to wipe out Shechem has now been channeled to meeting out justice for people who were involved in the Egel. Where is Shimon? Doesn't come. Their ways have parted a little bit. And it comes to a head, in a sense, in that episode where so many of Shimon fall, in the episode of Benos Moab at the end of Chumash Bamidbar, and head amongst them is one of the princes of Shimon, Zimri, and who kills him? Pinchas, from the tribe of Levi. In other words, the two now have become pitted against each other, because that energy and that drive, which again, so many years ago, Shimon and Levi, the two brothers themselves, you couldn't distinguish between the two, but they've taken somewhat different paths, to the extent that in the end, a descendant of Levi meets out justice to a descendant of Shimon, and both of them are really using the same quality. It's just for one of them, it's gotten out of hand. And for the other, it stayed in check. So these are the different journeys, so to speak, of Shimon and Levi, and that these are the two Ramban's explanations, more correctly, Ramban's two explanations of why Levi were nowhere near the numbers. Once again, they weren't part of the oppression, so they weren't part of Kash Kenya Bevechen Yefrotz, or number two, because of Kaas Hazaken Alehem, which is that's that type of thing I think only the Ramban could say, to draw that connection between Yaakov's words and see such a devastating results. There is a third explanation as to why Levi were so less than anyone else, and it comes from the Abarbanel, quite different than what we've said so far. Now, Rabbi Nell says, if you want to know why the Jewish people proliferated so much, why they increased so much, it wasn't just to show the Egyptians that you're trying to destroy them and it's not working, it's backfiring. It's more than that. They need to be ready to enter the land of Israel. All of it. Imagine that they had increased in numbers in a natural way over those 200 years, and number them at a few thousand or something like that, or maybe even a few tens of thousands, that they have a whole country to populate. It's in the interest of effectively being able to move in and take over the country, the land of Israel. There need to be a critical mass to allow them to do that. And if they're nowhere nearly enough in natural terms, so they will unnaturally increase to a country sustaining and country controlling amount of people. It's a very interesting way of looking at the increase of the Jewish people. It's with an eye on the land of Israel, says Abarbanel. You've got to be able to populate it. And because this is true, says Abarbanel, so the only people that need to increase in that way are those who will receive their nachlas, who will receive their tribal inheritance, because they need to be able to fill it out. Fundamentally. But Levi don't receive an inheritance. You need them, and they're the teachers, and etc., but they've got their own cities. So the requirement that there be an unusually large amount of them are naturally in order to fill out the land. They're not filling out the land. And therefore they can just increase under normal conditions and with normal rate of increase. So very interesting explanation of the Abarbanel to Ramban's question about why Levi, it's not so much that there were so few of them, it's that there weren't so many of them, as we've learned to phrase the question. Well, chapter 1 of Bamidbar is about the counting, but so is chapter 2, because they're counted again. And the reason why is because chapter 1 of Bamidbar counts them as Shvatim, as 12 units, called Shvatim. But then chapter 2 counts them as more composite units, the Machanos, the four camps that surround the Mishkan. And although there's many numbers and many names, etc., if we try and reach in and note one letter, we will see what that will yield for us. And how does it begin? You see, if we move to Perek Beis, so every machane, and of course there's four directions, there's 12 tribes, 12 by 4 is 3, so there's 3 tribes in every machane, and it goes through 1, 2, and 3. And in the bridge from tribe 2 and 3 in every machane, it, not surprisingly, connects it with a letter Vav. Let's illustrate by seeing the psukim. If we have a look at, again, so we're in Perek Beis, and let's see the second machane, which is machane Reuven. So first you have Reuven, and then you have Shimon. And then in Pasuk Yudalad, what does it say? Umate Gad, and the tribe of God. Very good. Reuven, Shimon, and the tribe of God. By the way, interestingly, and before we move on to the other examples, I cannot withhold from saying this. Once we appreciate that the tribes of Reuven, Shimon, and Gad were together, they're together in a machane, it may give us a completely different perspective on a very significant event later on in Chumash, namely that the tribes of Reuven and Gad wanted to stay on the east side of the Yarden. What's that all about? So, of course, the Pasuk does mention they had a lot of cattle, and it's a land of pasture, etc. It's very interesting how much they were prepared to forego in order to stay on the east side. There is a sefer called Sifsei Kohen al HaTorah. Sifsei Kohen, or the Shach al HaTorah, it's not related to the Shach who we know from Halacha, Reb Shapsa Cohen, but it's Rav Mordechai Cohen, who is from the Beis HaMedrash of the Arizal. And he gives an explanation for Reuven and Shimon that is absolutely dumbfounding. He explains, Reuven and Shimon wanted to stay on the east side of the Yarden, of the River Jordan. You know why? Because look who their neighbor is in the Midbar. Who do they live with? Shimon. That's the second camp. Reuven, Shimon, and Gad. So after everything that Shimon has done in those recent months, they were the ones that downward spiraled with the Benos Moav. They've had a terrible track record of late. And Reuven and Shimon felt that if we're their neighbors here, and it's just a matter of another of months, but we don't want to be their neighbors in there, better to stay on the east side. To get away from Shimon, it's very interesting. It also casts in a completely different light the way that they talk to Moshe. And it is noteworthy, because they come to Moshe and they say, you know, all these areas, it's so fertile, there's so much pasture, we have a lot of cattle, is it okay if we stay here? They number all of these towns. They're really, really detailing why they want to stay here. Which itself is very interesting. Because if we say that they like their money and they like their cattle, etc. But don't forget, even people who like their money, they get themselves together when they're talking to a rabbi. I mean, here they are approaching Moshe Rabbeinu. And they are unabashedly saying, there's so much pasture here, and we have so many cattle, and if you don't mind, we'd like to completely stay behind. I mean, how can they say that to Moshe? But from a certain point of view, we begin to understand that they may actually be protest a thing too much. In other words, the reason why they're making such a thing out of how much cattle they have is because it's not actually the real reason. So they're overstating it to camouflage the fact that they'll do whatever they can to not be neighbors of Shimon in the land of Israel. Anyway, that's a very, very interesting approach to that whole Mapitom, Reuven and Gad, more than anyone else. In any rate, we come back to where we are. We've seen that camp of three, Reuven, Shimon and Gad. This will repeat itself in Pasuk Kaf Dalet, when... Pasuk Kaf Beis. Okay, so then the third camp is Ephraim, and then Menashe, Pasuk Kaf Beis, Umate Binyamin. Very good. And finally, in Pasuk Kaf Tes, where you have the final camp of Dan and Asher, the third one is Umate Naphtali. This is so simple. Why are we making a point of looking at each of these verses, which just says, and number three? The reason is because in the first camp, it's not true. We have cited the psukim from camps number 2, 3, and 4. But now go back to the first one. And we will see in Pasuk Zion, and the first camp is Yehuda, Yisachar, and Zevulun. And the third one in that camp is Zevulun. Pasuk Zion says, Mate Zevulun, the camp of Zevulun. If we read the psukim in order, we wouldn't know that there's anything unusual. But that's why we prefaced by saying in the second, third, and fourth camp, it will always be Umate. The final tribe in the camp will be Umate. Why is it here? Where did the Vav go? Why is it not Umate Zevulun? Why is it Mate Zevulun? So much can hinge on a letter that isn't there. And what is the lesson for us here? Says the Balaturim. V'lo amar umate. It doesn't say umate with the vav kederach she'omer ba'achirim. Why? Because we're talking about the two tribes of Yisachar and Zevulun. What do we know about Yisachar and Zevulun? They have a relationship. They have an arrangement between them, whereby Zevulun is involved in business. Zevulun lechof yamim yishkon. Samach Zevulun betzei secha. Imports, exports, business, it's a whole enterprise. V'yisachar ba'ohalecha. And Yisachar are Yodei Bina Le'itim, they're studying Torah, and they have this arrangement between the two. Lefisha v'zevulun hayim mefarnes li'Yisachar. That Zevulun would provide materially for Yisachar and then take a share in the Torah learning of Yisachar. And that's why it doesn't say, says Balaturim, that's why it doesn't say Umate Zevulun. Why? Lefichach lo rotza hakosuf la'asoso tfeila lo. It didn't want to make Zevulun sound secondary, as an add-on here. You have Yisachar, oh, and there's also Zevulun. No. Rather, to teach you shesicharo gadol kamoso. They are absolutely together. The reward of Zevulun is the same as the reward of Sachar, of Yisachar. And that's why it says, lachin chashuv hakol kemate echad. That's why there's no vav. So that they're not even considered to be two tribes. It's one tribe, which is called Mate Yisachar, Mate Zevulun. But they're not even linked, because to link them would be to see them as two things. But it's almost one entity which has the name of Mate Yisachar, Mate Zevulun. And this is a fascinating remez to the idea of Yisachar and Zevulun, that they mamish become like one. This is alluded to, says Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, in Parshas Truma, by an interesting halacha which we know from the Mishkan, namely, all of the vessels in the Mishkan, they have poles in which they're carried. But when they reach a certain destination, the poles are removed. The exception, of course, are the poles of the Aron, because they stay. B'taba'os ha'aron, yihyu, yu'abadim, lo yasur mimenu. They never leave, they never depart. To the extent, says Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, that from a certain point of view, they're considered part of the kli. It's one vessel which has poles in it. But they're not just functional to get it from A to B. It's part of it. Because the poles, says Rabbi Yaakov, understandably, represent the support of Torah. And they never leave. It's one entity. That really echoes the words of the Balaturim, Mate Yisachar, Mate Zevulun. There are various statements in Chazal, we're not going to go into details, but just to reference them, that discuss the question as to whether the Sachar of Zevulun is equal in every respect to that of Yisachar. After all, Yisachar is doing the learning. It's some places it indicates that it is. The Gemara quotes a pasuk, Betzel ha-chachma, Betzel ha-kesef. The same shade, the same chuppah for the chachma and the kesef for the learning and material support. Sounds like they're exactly the same. Elsewhere, the Gemara seems to indicate that they're not exactly the same. The one who supports the Torah learning reaches a certain level. The one who's involved in the Torah learning themselves on a higher level. That's a Gemara in Brachos and Daf Lamed Daled. But either way, these represent either different aspects of the reward or different scenarios. But this is the concept. The other interesting question, which is pondered by the Mefarshim, when we say that Yisachar and Zevulun have this partnership, so does that mean that Yisachar actually has to part with half of his Sachar to give it to Zevulun? Is it a partnership that's halved? Or is it somehow a partnership that's doubled? Interesting Shaila. Most times when you enter a partnership and you share the dividends, so each side needs to share what they have. Zevulun shares his money with Yisachar. Maybe Yisachar needs to share his Sachar with Zevulun. And that seems to be the approach of the Meshech Chachma. That's why in the brachas, it is the approach of Meshech Chachma. That's why in Parshas Vayechi, when Yaakov talks about Yisachar, and Yisachar again is the Torah learner, it says Vayechi lemas oved. He needs to pay mas. He needs to pay revenue because he's in a partnership, and he needs to give up some of his sachar. Very interesting. The Arachaim HaKadosh famously says otherwise, that it's like fire, and as you light one candle from another, the fire just grows, it's not halved. These are interesting questions. But I think a very significant point to be made, which is made by the Ramah, and it's true in a sense, first and foremost for Torah learning, but for many other things also. And that is, says the Ramah in Hilchos Talmud Torah, this whole concept, this whole idea that you can have this partnership and for material support, a person can receive the sachar of the Torah learning. Says the Ramah, that can only happen if this arrangement is agreed upon before the whole thing begins. From the outset, if they have this arrangement, then it will work. But what if you have someone who's already learnt, and then someone else comes up to him and says, well, I'd like some sachar of your Torah, can I pay you for it? Says Ramah, it can't work. But the question is, what's the difference between before and after? In other words, we assume the money's the same, we assume the Torah is the same. How can it only work if it's arranged beforehand and not afterwards? But the Mefarshim say very simply, reward for a mitzvah only comes for a person who's part of that mitzvah. Rav Haigon has a famous response, and it's quoted in the Tshuvas of Maram al-Shakar. Rav Haigon says, reward for a mitzvah is not something that you carry around in a pouch, that you can dispense to anyone for a sum of money. It can't be done. Not that it's morally incorrect. It can't be done. The sachar naturally and inexorably pertains to the one who did the mitzvah. I mean, that's what sachar mitzvah is. So if you've done the mitzvah, so you get your sachar, hopefully you won't forfeit it, you certainly can't sell it, you can't transfer it to someone else. But if it's arranged from the outset, it's different. Why? Because if Zevulun is helping Yisachar to learn, so he has a portion in the mitzvah of Yisachar's learning, so then of course he can lay claim, naturally, to a portion of the sachar. It's a joint venture from the outset. They share the mitzvah, that's why they share the sachar. But if one did the mitzvah, the other one cannot purchase the sachar. That's what's behind the difference between before and after. It's a very broad discussion, but that is the point al regel achas, and certainly worth reflecting upon. So from here, I'd like to move back to Perek Beis. Actually, we haven't left Perek Beis, so let's move on in Perek Beis. To see Pasuk Yud Zayin. Perek Beis Yud Zayin. So again, we're describing the Machanos. Okay. so far before Pasuk Yud Zayin, we've seen two of the Machanos. Machane of Yehuda with the two accompanying tribes, and Machane Reuven with the two accompanying tribes. Then Pasuk Yud Zayin says, "V'nasa Ohel Moed Machane Halevim B'socha Machanos." And then the Ohel Moed will travel within the camps. "Kasher Yachanu Ken Yisa'u." As they encamp, so shall they travel. "Ish Ayado L'Diglehem." So what are we being informed here? Is that this formation of Machanos was preserved not only, or pertained not only when they were encamped, but was also preserved in some way when they traveled. It was also that way. In the same way that the Levim were surrounded by the other tribes when they were encamped, they're also surrounded because there's two camps that go before them, two behind them, also kind of surrounded in that way, even when they travel. Okay, good to know. There's an interesting and rather cryptic comment of the Ibn Ezra on this pasuk. Because what have we said so far? Two tribes go, then Levi, and then the other... Pardon me. Two camps go, two camps of three go, then Levi, and then the other two camps. Says Ibn Ezra, Ha'inyan mevu'ar lekaman perik yud. This matter is elaborated upon later on in chapter 10. That's all he says. But what does he mean by this? It happens to be that if we look later on in Perek Yud, we'll discover that the tribe of Levi didn't all travel together. When the Jewish people traveled, so some of the families, and we know there's three families of Levi, Gershon, Kohath, Merari, the two families of Gershon and Merari traveled after the first Machaneh. In other words, the first Machaneh to go is Machaneh Yehuda. And then after they travel, you already have a representation from the tribe of Levi, the two families of Gershon and Merari. Then the second camp, Dego Machaneh Reuven. And then you have the family of Kohath. So Levi are split up into two. What does the Ibn Ezra mean to indicate here? It seems, not to put too fine a point on it, two families of Levi have gone missing from our chapter's discussion. Because in our parsha, in Perek Beis, the only Leviim who were described as traveling are the ones in between the two sets of two camps, the one mamish in the middle. That's only one of the three families. Two of the other three families have already, and we will discover later on in Perek Yud, they move as soon as the first camp has moved. And there's no mention of them. Where do they go? Where did they disappear to? That is the Ibn Ezra's way of asking that question when he says the matter is elaborated upon later on, meaning we have less than full information here. We've only spoken about some Levium traveling, not the others. What's it all about? Who can explain such a thing? But the answer is provided by Reb Velvo Soloveitchik, the Brisker Rav. And I do not hesitate to introduce his words by saying it will have Brisk written all over it. It is a classic Brisk analysis of the situation, but see how it then absolutely explains the psukim. Says Reb Velvo Soloveitchik, we're all wondering, how come we don't hear more about the Levium traveling in our parsha? We only hear about one family, we don't hear about the other families. That's our question. Later on, we'll hear about all of them. But at this stage, only about the Kohath who goes in the middle of the two camps, the two sets of camps. Says the Brisker Rav, Reb Velvo Soloveitchik, I'd be more inclined to ask a different question. Why are we talking about anyone traveling at this stage? After all, the subject of Perek Beis of Bamidbar in our parsha is the Machanos, is how they would encamp. We're not yet talking about how they would travel. Later on, in Perek Yud, in Parshas Baluscha, the topic of the Perek is how they would travel. So you've got to tell me who would travel, and don't leave anyone out. And it doesn't leave anyone out. But here, I don't understand why it brings anyone in to talk about traveling. Our Parsha is encampment. The later chapter is traveling. So leave the traveling for the traveling Parsha and just have the encamping. So actually, why do we describe anyone traveling in our Perek? It's a bit of a disarming question. We were wondering, why did anyone go missing from Levi? And the Brisker Rav is asking, why is anyone here from Shevet Levi in being described as traveling? Well, the answer is, our chapter, Perek Beis, is about the Machanos. And to that end, it tells us everything we need to know about these camps. Now, we do know that these camps had different statuses. Meaning, you had these three concentric camps. The camp of the Shekhinah, the camp of the Levim, the camp of Yisrael. And there are halachic ramifications. Different people who were tamei for different reasons couldn't enter some of them, right? A Metzora needs to go out of all three. And other people can't be in Machane Levia. And other people not in Machane Shechina. There are halachic ramifications to their status as Machane. And that's what our chapter is devoted to, Perek Beis. So let's ask an interesting question, which the Gemara asks. What happens when the Jewish people travel? When Bnei Yisrael traveled? So in a sense, they're in transit. Do the categories of the Machanos still apply, or are they just suspended until they encamp somewhere else? If you were Tomei, and you were thrown out of the camp of Israel because you were a Metzora, but now they're traveling, can you travel along with them because the camp, but there's no camp? Or do we say, no, the camp is in transit, so you still can't be part of it? It's a halachic question. It's a mitzvah question. And amazingly, the Gemara says that even when we were in transit, the status of the Machanos were preserved. And you know where the Gemara derives it from? From our Pasuk. Pasuk Yud Zayin. Let's read again Pasuk Yud Zayin, which reads, V'nasa Oel Moed Bestoch, V'nasa Oel Moed Machane HaLevim Betoch HaMachanos. The Oel Moed, the Machane HaLevim, would travel within the Machanos. Says the Gemara, what do you see from here? Even when they travel, it's still called the Oel Moed. And they're still called Machane Levim. And the other camps are still called the Machanos. As the Pasuk goes on to say, Ka'asher Yachanu, Ken Yisau. Just as they was in camp, so would they travel. Meaning just as the Machane existed when they're encamped, obviously, it continues to exist in transit as they travel. And that's why our Pasuk is already talking about them traveling. It's not yet devoted to the order of travel. It's devoted to the status of these places, these domains called Machanos. It only mentions the travels because you need to know that status remains even when they travel. Aha. So let's ask an interesting question. The 12 tribes, or 11 of the 12 tribes, they have the status of Machane Yisrael, wherever they are. Uh-huh. And what about the Levim? Well, where they encamp, wherever they are, is Machane Levim, because they're around the Mishkan. What about when they travel? Meaning, at this point, when they travel, the families of Levi split up. The family of Kehas remains together with the Mishkan. But the other two families of Gershon and Merari, they're in a different place. They're not with the Mishkan anymore. So here's an interesting shaila. If we say that the status of Machane Levia remains even when they travel, but does it remain with each family of Levium wherever they are? Or do we say the definition of Machane Levia is the ones who surround the Mishkan, but in transit only one of those families surrounds the Mishkan? Says Rav Velvel Soloveitchik, if you look in Rashi, in Zvachim, Daf Samach Aleph Amud Beis, which he very kindly has done for us, you will see that Rashi says that the Machane Levia still exists, even when they travel, because they're with the Ohel Moed. And what does that tell us? It's only the part of Levi who's with the Ohel Moed that maintains the status of Machane Levia. Putting all this together, says Rav Velvel, now can we understand why we didn't mention all of the families of Levium traveling in this chapter. Later on, we mentioned all of them, but here we didn't. Because later on, it's about the order of travel, so you have to talk about how everyone traveled. But our chapter is only about the Machanos, and it only mentions the travel to tell us that even when they traveled, the status of Machane pertained. And that's why it only mentions the family of the Levium for whom this was true, namely the family of Kehas, who traveled around the Ohel Moed, but it doesn't mention the other two families. So on the one hand, you have this halachic analysis, but it's also look back at the psukim, it answers pshat questions that it's difficult to know how else they would be answered, and that is Kedarka Shel Torah, classic Riskarov. So we, just as our final comment for this evening, again, back to the world of Remez, and what we've seen, as we always know, is that the Torah transmits its messages on many wavelengths, and we have the Pshat and Medrash Halacha and Remez, as we've seen. And we want to go back to the end of Perek Aleph. That is to say, Perek Aleph, Pasuk Nun Aleph. Okay, so the tribes have been counted, and then Levi is counted, and also a bit of description as to what Levi should do. Uvin Soa HaMishkan, again, Perek Aleph, Pasuk Nun Aleph, Uvin Soa HaMishkan, when the Mishkan travels, Yeridu Asoa Leviim, the Leviim should take the Mishkan down, Uvachanos HaMishkan, and then when it's encamped again, Yakim Asoa HaLeviim, they should set it up again, Vahazar HaKarev Yumas. And it's a very, very serious, meaning if you're not a Levi, you can't go anywhere near there. And they themselves can't go where they shouldn't go, in terms of once the Mishkan has been set up again. It's very interesting, as much as they were the ones who set up the Mishkan, but once they've set it up, they can't go in there. They're also Zarim for the Mishkan, and other people certainly so. Why are we back in this pasuk? There is a fascinating comment which is made a number of times throughout the course of his Perush by Rabbeinu Bachya. And that is that we are familiar with the connotation of what we call the Shem Havaya, the name of Yudke Vavke, and that is that it's a name of Rachamim. The name of Yudke Vavke is a name of Rachamim. It's always to be found in that with that association. Okay, and there are even times when the name Yudke Vavke will be alluded to in Rosh Tevis, which is also very auspicious in terms of showing there's an element of Rachamim, of divine compassion there. But there is another possibility, says Rabbeinu Bachya. Namely, there are times when you will find that the allusion to the Shem Havaya is backwards. And when you find that, it's because it's the opposite. In other words, the opposite of Rachamim is Din. Sometimes the Torah denotes the opposite of compassion, rather strict justice, by taking the Shem Havaya, but alluding to it backwards. What's an example of such a phenomenon? Our Pasuk, where we will see this twice in the Pasuk. If we go back again, looking obviously with a very different eyes now, Pasuk Nun Aleph, Uvin Soha Mishkan, when the Mishkan travels, Yerido Soha Leviim, the Leviim shall take it down. Uvachanos HaMishkan Yakimo Soha Leviim. If you look at the words, back up two or three words, HaLeviim Uvachanos HaMishkan Yakimu. So take the Rosh Tevis there, of those four words, He of HaLeviim, Vav of Uvachanos, He of HaMishkan, and Yud of Yakimu. That is He, Vav, He, Yud. That's the Shem Havaya backwards. Why? Because it's a Midas Hadin situation, potentially. It's very serious. And in fact, it's so serious that the Pasuk goes on to say, Yokimu also HaLeviim Vazar HaKarev Yumas. The final four words in that Pasuk is once again Rosh Tevis. He, Vav, He, Yud. So this Pasuk has Din written all over it, because it's the very, very sensitive area of not going, crossing the boundaries that one is not allowed to go. And this is a classic example of this idea of the Shem Havaya alluded to backwards, is the reverse of Rachamim, rather situation of Midas Hadin. It's interesting to note just one or two other cases, each one with its own inflection in this idea, because Rabbeinu Bachya has already discussed this matter much earlier on, in Parshas Noach, in fact. Why? Because at the end of Parshas Noach, we have Migdal Bavel. the Tower of Babel. And what happened? So Hashem disperses them all. And that's their punishment. The Pasuk reads, this is in Perik Bracious, Perik Yud Aleph, Pasuk Tes. Al Kain Karashim Babel. That therefore this place was called Babel. Kisham Balal Hashem Svaskala Aretz, because there Hashem mixed up the languages of all the land. Umisham Hefitzam Hashem Opnei Kala Aretz, and from there Hashem dispersed them over all the land. Says Rabbeinu Bachi, if you look at the pasuk, the words Haaretz Umisham Hefitzam Hashem. Once again, Rosh Tevis. Hey, Vav, Hey, Yud. Why? Because it was Midas Hadin. In other words, this is a time of punishment. And as they're being dispersed, so you see the rem as to the fact that that the attribute of justice is being meted out against them. But Rabbeinu Bachya makes an added point there. Because the four words, if we hear the harmony here, or the counterpoint, the four words which have the Shem Havaya backwards are the words Haaretz, hey, Umisham, love, Hefitzam, hey, Hashem. Hashem meaning Yud Kei Vav Kei. In other words, the Yud, which is the beginning of the word, which is the end of the backward Shem Havaya, is actually the beginning of the Shem Havaya itself. The final Hey Vav Hey Yud, the word that starts with Yud, is actually the Shem Havaya in order. So that's an interesting contrast. What is it? Is it backwards or forwards? Rosh HaTevis has it backwards, but then it ends being forwards. Says Rabbeinu Bachya, yes. Because as we know, when it comes to the Dor HaPalaga, right, the generation of the Tower of Babel, as much as they were punished and what they did was reprehensible, it was nowhere near as severe as what happened to the generation of the Flood. And the reason why is because for all of their faults and whatever, it was significant enough, but they were together. They weren't against each other. They weren't violent and terrorizing each other. There was a joint venture, very ill-conceived, very misdirected, but there was achdus amongst them. Rashi says this. And therefore, as much as they got a sentence, it was mild. And how do we see the mitigation of compassion even within justice? That as much as the Shem Havaya is backwards to denote the attribute of justice, but the final Yud is the beginning of, is the name of Shem Havaya forwards. There's an element of compassion within that justice. It was a mitigated sentence. And the final example for us this evening, there's many, many examples Rabbeinu Bachya gives, but again, just to show a different type of this, from Megillas Esther, Haman, at the height of his powers, and he brags about everything that he has, but in his famous words, V'chol zeh einenu shoveh li, none of it means anything as long as I see Mordechai. That was the beginning of the end for him. Says Rabbeinu Bachya, if you look at the words, zeh einenu shoveh li, the sofei tevos. And here we move from Rosh Tevos to Sofei Tevos. The final letters of those four words, Ze Einenu Shoveli, is Hey Vav Hey Yud, the name Havaya backwards. Why? Because this is the beginning of the end for Haman. Until now, he's been doing fantastically well, but that's all over now. It's about to be reversed. And what's so interesting is, Rabbeinu Bachya says, that's what's denoted by the backwards Shem Havaya at the end. In other words, because it's a process that hadn't been like that until now. He enjoyed great success, but it's about to be reversed. And therefore, a reversal of fortune through Midas Hadin is denoted specifically by the backward Shem Havaya at the end. It didn't start out that way. It's going to end up that way. So we see so many different, the delicacy of how the remez is encased within the words. Is it the beginning of the opening letter? Is it the final letter? And what are the words themselves? And kedarka shel Torah, as we say, these are the ways in which, of the ways in which the Torah transmits its messages. So we've had our blend ourselves this evening of of Pshat and of Halacha and of Remez. That's the symphony of Torah. And we'll leave it over here for this evening. I wish you all a good night and a wonderful week ahead. All the very best. Thank you.